supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf today unveiled his proposed budget for the next fiscal year. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Wolf called for boosts to education and senior care spending and proposes paying for those increases by closing what he calls corporate tax loopholes and by streamlining state government.
By identifying specific programs that could work more efficiently and others that are no longer working at all, this budget proposes reforms that altogether will save taxpayers more than $2 billion.
The Democrats stress that his budget includes no broad-based tax increases, also acknowledging the challenges that lie ahead for the approval process with a majority Republican legislature. Wolf, nevertheless, remains optimistic about the outcome.
The people who sent us here want to see progress. They deserve to see progress. And when we've worked together, we have been able to deliver that progress.
Let's get reaction to Wolf's budget address from House Majority Leader, Republican Dave Reed. Mr. Reed, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome.
At first glance, this budget proposal seems certainly closer to GOP values than the previous two that were offered.
Yeah, I think it really stands in stark contrast to how the governor started his term 2 years ago when he came before the General Assembly and proposed a $12 billion tax increase with over 100 new taxes in one form or another. You know, today I think represented a new starting point, a new beginning, and a new opportunity by taking the personal income tax and sales tax increases off the table, by being willing to have a discussion on restructuring and reinventing government. I think it gives us a much more realistic starting point this time around than we've had over the last 2 years.
And so how do you foresee that conversation going forward in the weeks and months to come?
Well, I think he put a lot of proposals on the table. I'm sure there'll be some proposals we agree with, some we disagree with. I'm sure we'll put some proposals on the table as well, along with our colleagues in the Senate. The appropriations hearing process will start within a week here, and we'll start to really flush out some of his ideas and see how we can accumulate other ideas as well to bring a final budget product, hopefully, before the end of June.
Governor Wolf said in part, and I quote, "The truth is the people of the Commonwealth have elected a Democratic governor and the most Republican legislature in modern history." No doubt. How do you anticipate your constituents in Indiana County will react to this budget plan?
Look, I think they are going to be very happy without a personal income tax or a sales tax increase. You know, the devil's in the details, and we have a responsibility to ask the tough questions both on policy and on the logistical side of merging and consolidating agencies. But overall, I think folks are interested in government operating more effectively, transforming to what we expect government to be in the year 2017, and focusing less on the cost of government within the bureaucracy in Harrisburg, and more on driving those dollars out to the folks actually implementing the programs and receiving the assistance that's needed in one form or another.
The governor says that form of merging and consolidating can save some $2 billion a year, but that's less than the projected deficit. Where do you foresee the balance perhaps coming from, if not in the form of new taxes?
You know, I think there's other revenue or potential revenue options out there as well. More movement forward on privatizing our liquor system could be a revenue source, $100, $200 million at a time. You know, so we think there are options available that, you know, we're going to have the conversation with the governor. We're going to enter into it with an open mind, and we would expect that he would do the same.
Your colleague, House Speaker Mike Terzai, specifically said he'd like to see more emphasis on privatizing government functions, encouraging school choice, and reducing state debt. Do you have specifics on your wish list going forward?
Look, I think we want to get a fiscally responsible budget done on time this year, bring predictability back to the budgeting process, address the major cost drivers within that budget, our correctional system, our pension system, our human service delivery system, and our educational system. And I think at the end of the day, what we want to do is make government more effective, more efficient, and more responsive in the year 2017. And, you know, of course, part of that discussion, I think, is the idea and the topic of how we fund our public schools with a local school property tax is an idea that a lot of our members, and I don't think it's just Republican, I think it's Democratic as well, have an interest in reshaping how we fund our public schools.
And of course, nobody would argue against delivering a budget on time. Good luck toward that end, and thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
House Majority Leader, Republican Dave Reed. In a study published in the journal Pediatrics, researchers say there's a strong association between juvenile detention and physical and mental health later in life. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
The study's authors analyzed data from around 14,000 adults in a congressionally funded data set called the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health. They looked at the relationship between how long someone was incarcerated and their adult health. They also controlled for several factors, like someone's baseline health and sociodemographic factors. The authors concluded that youth incarceration is associated with worse health and mental health later in life. Mental health outcomes got worse the longer someone was incarcerated, says study lead author Elizabeth Barnert at UCLA.
I think that being in the justice system is often very traumatic for young people. The juvenile justice system was intended to be rehabilitative, but it has become increasingly punitive.
She says the relationship between health and incarceration is complex. Jessica Fireman from Philadelphia's Juvenile Law Center says she's not surprised by the research. She believes conditions for kids inside juvenile facilities are often harsh.
They're separated from their families. They may be placed in solitary confinement. They may experience shackles or pepper spray.
Both Fireman and researcher Barnert say for the last 10 years, the trend in juvenile justice is to keep more kids out of facilities and in their homes and communities. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
The federal mandate finding transgender students should be able to use bathrooms and locker rooms matching their gender identities is one of the most divisive issues facing public schools. Parents on both sides are willing to fight and sue for what they think is best for their kids. Two Lehigh Valley families got very publicly swept up in media coverage of the issue last year. But as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports, behind sensational headlines lies space for common ground.
Ah, to be a suburban preteen, those precious years post-playground and pre-driver's license when chain restaurants, in this case Applebee's, are prime hangouts.
Strawberry sparkler, Miss Twist, strawberry sparkler, strawberry, dewberry burst, Mountain Dew, dewberry burst, raspberry.
Strawberry sparkler.
12-year-old Ari Bowman is sitting in a booth with his friends and the cast of Extra Ticket, his Lehigh County Middle School's fall play. He plays Steve, a small part, but central to the plot, which revolves around precious tickets to the hit Broadway musical Hamilton.
I basically gave the girl, the two tickets in the first place, so I kind of, started the whole thing.
A few years ago, Bowman, who's wearing black sweatpants and has a buzzed haircut, might have been cast in a different role. Bowman is transgender. In fifth grade, he began attending school as a boy. His mom, Elisa, says it took her a while to get on board with his transition, especially the part about him using the boys' locker room.
I was a wreck the first time he used the locker room. I was so scared of what other kids might do. And it was completely uneventful. Nobody said anything to him. Nobody looked at him. His friends changed right next to him.
The stakes are high. Before being allowed to use the boys' facilities, Elisa says Ari would simply not drink water all day to avoid needing the bathroom.
We were walkers, so I'd pick him up from school, and he'd be, dancing the whole way home, I can't make it, I can't make it, I can't make it. And then he'd dehydrate himself so that that wouldn't happen.
In addition to saving his bladder, being able to use the boys' bathroom helps Ari's mental health. Studies of transgender youth show lack of acceptance contributes to higher depression and suicide rates among trans kids. Then, this past summer, 14-year-old Sigourney Coyle, a student at a different school in the same district, aired her frustrations over the mandate at an East Penn school board meeting.
I am a woman, and I identify as a woman, and you can't make me change in front of someone who I don't identify with, who is physically male.
Coverage of Coyle's speech quickly went viral, landing headlines everywhere from BuzzFeed to the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer. Coyle and Bowman have never met. But on the other side of town, Coyle's speech hit Elisa Bowman like a ton of bricks.
And I was like, wow, I thought we had support until that happened. And so I went to this other place of being scared again.
So, at the next school board meeting, Ari stood up in front of the same body to share what it's like being a transgender student, something many of his classmates didn't know about him. At the end, the superintendent shook his hand. That could be the end of the story, but it's not. The Coyles have their own story, which shows just how complicated implementing the mandate is and how easy it is for people on both sides to talk past each other.
All kinds of headlines with skewed perspectives on it from both sides of the fence.
That's Sigourney's mom, Erin.
And that's when all of the hate mail started.
Yeah, threats.
Yeah, death threats.
She says there's a lot you don't know if you just heard her daughter's viral soundbite. For one thing, their family is Christian, but they're not, in her words, the religious nutcases left-leaning media portrayed them to be.
My daughter and I especially, we've always really felt live and let live. You know, I can believe very strongly in something without inflicting it upon everybody else.
Sigourney also bends some gender norms herself, like entering a high school carpentry program to further her dreams of being a missionary. Now, the Coyles don't support the bathroom mandate. Like many critics, they feel it was an overreach by the federal government. But they say her speech was in response to weeks of back and forth with the school district about finding an acceptable private changing option for Sigourney, like in a bathroom stall or behind a shower curtain. That's something the bathroom mandate suggests as a best practice for schools, as Sigourney says she wrote in a letter to the school board.
A letter came back that said you can change privately in the nurse office, but the bathroom stalls in the locker room aren't allowed.
School district officials wouldn't comment, saying communications with parents are confidential. The school finally offered Coyle a chance to take gym class in the summer and avoid the locker room altogether. Without passing gym, she can't graduate high school. And while the initial hubbub has died down, cultural anxieties about gender and bodies don't change overnight. The Supreme Court has decided to hear a case on schools that go against the mandate, and a ruling could inflame tensions again. But some things have changed, says Erin Coyle. Before they spoke up, her family didn't know anyone in the school who was transgender.
We actually were contacted by two transgender students that are in her school, in her class, in her grade. And at first, they were very upset.
On Facebook, the students accused the Coyles of being transphobic and too focused on what trans bodies look like and not what it's like to be trans. After chatting online, Coyle and the students found common ground. The students empathized with the bullying Sigourney faced, and they support her requests for privacy. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
The Delaney sisters were 101 and 103 years old when their memoir called Having Their Say was published in 1993. It took a spot on the New York Times bestseller list for half a year. They had a lot to say in Having Their Say. It's a sweeping look at being Black, Southern, and living in a time of great change. A stage adaptation by Emily Mann, who runs McCarter Theater in Princeton, is now being done by Philadelphia Theater Company. Newsworks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
This thoroughly charming show is easy to enjoy as a character study or a down-home history discussion. I didn't find much of a play in it. It's more like a pleasant table discussion at someone's house. In fact, it takes place in the home owned by Sadie and Bessie Delaney, two inseparable and unmarried sisters, each living in her second century.
People are always asking us how we live to be over 100 years old. And I tell them because we never married. We never had husbands to worry us to death.
They are feisty and welcoming, independent and smart. The Delaney sisters grew up in North Carolina with parents who were pillars of the Black community. Their dad, born a slave, became the nation's first Black Presbyterian bishop. The sisters each went to New York City, became well-known in Harlem, and got advanced degrees. Sadie was a high school teacher. Bessie was a dentist. By the time the play is set in 1993, they've lived in the South before it was segregated, then through segregation, and into the civil rights era. In the play, the sisters expound on their family and its roots, the continuing challenges of being Black and being women, and the gift of being American. Their anecdotes are sometimes revealing and other times go nowhere. But their satisfactions and successes drew me into having our say, which is like a one-woman show but with two and without the manufactured conflict you often find in those pieces. It's performed by Perry Gaffney and Shireen Snow, two actresses who channel these sisters so well, you might think something psychic's going on. Their rich performances, along with projections of the real Delaneys, take us into the family's embrace. That's a comforting place to be. Having Our Say, the Delaney Sisters' First 100 Years, runs through February 19th at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Center City. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Howard Shapiro is Newsworks theater blogger. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, Philadelphia poet laureate Yolanda Wisher previews an event at the Rosenbach Library remembering Black Opals, Philadelphia's own Harlem Renaissance-era literary journal. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.